Hi, everyone. Welcome back to In a Click, a podcast about unveiling the mysteries of our digitally networked world. My guest today is Pamela Rogers. She's currently a senior coordinator in research and professional learning and is an adjunct professor at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Education. Today, we're going to chat about the stigma of spirituality in academia, in particular, astrology and tarot card reading. I had so much fun recording this episode, and I really hope you enjoy it too. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Pamela Rogers. It really intrigued me talking about the stigma around astrology and tarot card reading. And I think that there's a lot of misconception, and
it's become so much more popularized in the last, I would say, 5 years or so, especially in the last couple of years. But when I started into it, even say 10 years ago, when I started reading for people, it was so still hush hush. Like, I was very careful who I spoke to about anything about this. Even now, I've only opened up to several people in my life about it. So, so speaking about it like this is not only a big step, but it's something that you have to get over.
Well, where did the fear come from? What was it based in?
Well, there's a lot of stigma around it still. And I mean, people historically have been harmed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how do I put this? Like, people have been murdered for this. Yeah. Like, anybody who has practiced any kind of occult or divination, meaning any kind of readings, predictive work, tarot, astrology, anything like that, reading tea leaves, even, you know, they were seen to be doing the devil's work or as witches, or anti-Christian, or either, like, you know, going against the will of God. So a lot of people were outcast or imprisoned or worse.
I'm just wondering, in terms of like a global perspective, this is like a very westernized stigma, or?
Well, I don't know for sure, but in terms of even just looking at the places in the world where astrology has really come out of, it's basically everywhere but Western Europe.
Oh.
Yeah. So like Mesoamerica, South America, like all of the Americas,
basically. Yeah.
I have their own understanding of the cosmos and cosmology, which is, you know, the place of people within the cosmos, which is very close to astrology. There's Mayan astrology, there's Chinese astrology, there's astrology, Vedic astrology, which is from the ancient civilization, the Indus Valley civilization. And then there's Babylonian astrology, ancient Greek, ancient Egyptian as well.
Ooh.
So you have, yeah, so I mean, you have, I mean, and I'm sure lots of other places in Africa as well. Ethiopia, I know for sure. There's practitioners as well as like ancient wisdom keepers and having to do with the cosmos as well. So I think that's a really interesting question, because the more I look into it, the more I see how against any kind of form of divination, astrology, or any kind of like outcast knowledge that the Western world was just completely against. And it was because anything outside of the church was considered blasphemous.
For me, before I really started chatting with you about it, and what I knew of astrology was from what I read in the back of Cosmopolitan. And so I wonder how that plays into it too, because that's the mainstream kind of way that we read it and see it. Like, do you think that that has kind of, not tainted it, but like has devalued it a little bit?
I find it so interesting, because growing up, reading the newspaper horoscopes, I remember always thinking like, this doesn't make sense. Like, this doesn't... I don't understand. Like, you know, you try to either like make it fit with your life, or, you know, it rarely fits, because those tiny horoscopes are based off of if your sun sign was in the placement of your first house. Okay. So your rising sign is very important in astrology, and it sets the entire chart.
Okay.
But people rarely have their star sign, their sun sign, which is what you would read, in your first house. So it's based on a very specific placement. So there's so much more to it. And also some of them are you know, quite generic. It's almost like they're pulled out of a hat and replicated all the time too. You kind of hear the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
So people might read those and think that, oh, that doesn't make sense. And they attribute astrology to just their sun sign, when really there's so much more going on.
It's really quite complex.
It's very complex. And every planetary placement, it depends which house, one of 12, it's sitting in, depends which sign it's in, how it aspects other planets. That means the angles it makes with other planets. Yeah, whether it's retrograde or not, whether it's beside other planets or not, like there's so much to look into. There's a lot involved. So for example, you are a Cancer, but your moon is in Leo.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And the time that you gave me, because it does have to be a specific birth time, it actually puts you at a Virgo rising.
Oh.
So that would mean, yeah, I know. You're like, ooh. Yeah. So Virgo rising. Well, Virgo is a sign associated with Mercury. Okay. It's an earth sign. So Mercury usually in Virgo has to do with being analytical, make good researchers, usually good at writing, speaking, those types of things. Mm-hmm. But your emotional fulfillment and how you relate emotionally to people will come through your Leo. As well as all kinds of other things having to do with the moon and the rising, right? So the rising sets your entire chart. So your rising sign is what people might first get from you. But as you get more comfortable with people, they would get more of the Cancerian side, probably like the more nurturing, caring, that kind of thing. But you might come across as more like analytical, more maybe a little bit more standoffish at the beginning.
Oh, that's totally fair. See, for me, I often think I'm a really good judge of character when I know somebody, but I'm not always a very good judge of character when I first meet somebody. And yeah. I always wonder if it has something to do with like how you are perceived immediately versus who you are.
Well, oh, definitely. And I get this all the time. People saying I'm intimidating when they first meet me. I get that a lot. I'm like, why? I don't get it. I don't understand that. But it's that scorpionic, like I can really like have the very like serious look on my face. If I'm like deep in thought or anything else, like I might come across as more, maybe more intense than I am.
I'm not sure. I'm just trying to think of my first impression of you. And remember we taught together for a WADS class?
Yeah.
That's where I met you. And I thought that you were so self-assured. That was my first. Yeah. Like knew who you were, super confident, structured. I was like, no one can mess with that girl.
That's what people think.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, some of those things are true some of the time.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that is like, yeah, the go-to characteristic at all.
Okay. And then there's also like love signs as well, right?
Yeah.
You taught me a little bit about that the first time you read my tarot cards.
Oh, right.
And you told me who I was in a relationship, how I basically participated. And I was like, you could not be more right. And this was basically our first time having a beer together too. So I was a bit like, it was eerie to me. I was like, how do you know? How do you know that?
Well, it's so funny. There's so many different types of astrology for one. Mm-hmm. So mundane astrology looks at like cities and countries and their charts. Cool. There's astrology for health. There's astrology for relationships, which is called synastry astrology. Okay. I can't even say synastry astrology. There's all different types of astrology, but when you do look into relationships, basically you want to look at the placement of Venus and Mars, especially even the moon sign, where they're placed. That's interesting. Sorry, I'm looking at your chart right now. Because you do have Leo, of course, very, very Leo-y for your moon, your Mars and your Venus. Hmm. They're in your 11th and 12th houses. But you do have Pisces on your seventh house cusp. So the seventh house often shows you.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you can make sense of this, but
no.
The seventh house, yeah.
There are just like, house. It's a circle with like so many intricate lines. Yeah, I have no idea.
So the cusp of the seventh house shows what type of partner we're interested in as well.
Hmm.
And so yours is Pisces, but halfway through your seventh house, it turns into Aries.
Hmm.
Yeah. So maybe somebody who is caring, kind of dreamy. I mean, Pisces can be super creative people, imaginative people, but then Aries is like the really fiery, kind of like dominant leader type. Yeah. So
that sounds
maybe
right.
It's both of those people. Yeah. Kicking around somewhere.
That's exactly what I need.
Yeah.
Someone who will snuggle me and tell me what to do, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then go over and make the money. That's exactly.
And a really good cocktail, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So it totally depends on, it depends on so many different things. And then to complicate matters, there's also your progressed chart.
Okay.
So this is where the planets, how far they move from the time of your birth chart. So I was born an Aquarius sun. And after however many years, 37 years now, I'm an Aries sun as of like 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that your natal chart is still your natal chart, but it's just as you progress through life, there's different parts of your like personal evolution that take place through time.
And through the alignment of the planets.
Yeah.
The more I learn, the more interesting it is to me. It's also fun to see how things align. And it also kind of gives a little bit of hope because if it can explain a specific moment in time that's either difficult or strange, you know it'll pass. But then you also know that maybe there's a reason for that. And that's comforting.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what it's for. And so when friends who don't know a lot about astrology ask me about it, they're like, so I don't understand what the point is to it, for example. And I always say, well, it's like knowing the weather. So you're not going to plan to go to the beach when it's raining. And you're not going to go like on a long drive if there's a blizzard.
Yeah.
So it's very much like that in terms of sometimes travel, buying a house or like any kind of big purchase, starting a new project. Publishing, mm-hmm. like there are specific times where it doesn't mean that you won't be able to do it. It's just, there are times where it'll be easier to do certain things than other times.
Yeah.
Sure. You can go to the beach when it's raining. It's not going to be as good.
I guarantee that.
No. And so, yeah, I think it just helps with even like logistically, if you want to think of it that way, planning, but even relationship wise, you can get into some of the better or maybe more challenging aspects of relationships, whether that's with friends or family or with romantic partners. You can look at all of that.
And so let's say that you see something in their chart or in their cards and it makes you weary for one reason or another. So is there ever a moment in time when you would say like, maybe don't make a big decision at this point in time, or, you know, just so you know, this is going to be a tricky time for you. So is that how you would navigate it?
Yeah, no, definitely. And that has happened a lot where things come up, and oftentimes, especially when it comes to relationships, people will come and talk to me if they are having, I don't want to say doubts, but you know, they're trying to work their way through thinking about a few things that might not be sitting right. And so if things do come up, it's not me telling somebody what to do.
No.
It's a way of getting people to talk through perhaps what they're thinking and feeling, and using the cards to facilitate that conversation. And so I think that's one of the misconceptions too. People think like they're going to get their fortune told, fortune told, or like, you're going to tell me, you know, how do I do this? And that's not the point. It's not the point to give advice. But for example, it'd be like, you know, a lot of people now talk about Mercury retrograde.
Mm-hmm.
So have you heard about Mercury retrograde before?
I don't know what it means, but yeah, I hear it all the time. I pretend I do, but
it happens three times a year.
Okay,
so a retrograde planet means that from the Earth's surface, it appears as if the planet is going backwards. It is not.
Okay.
It's not going backwards. It's just three times a year, it appears as if, just the way that it travels around the Earth, that Mercury is going backwards. But it's not. But in those times, there's a lot of memes about this now. I don't know if you've seen any of these, but basically, you know, it's becoming more popularized. and in the, I guess, public consciousness. But, you know, there are more issues with technology, with travel plans, with signing large contracts. Mm-hmm. So if you're starting a new job, just, you know, it's always advised to triple check things, emails, triple check what you're sending, to making sure you're not replying all, you know, those types of things that you would normally do anyway, but there's just a heightened chance at certain points in time.
Okay.
That, and that's one of those times. And so if somebody's going to buy a house during that time, I would advise that people just make sure that, like, the paperwork is all legit and that you really look things over. But I would never say to not do something.
Of course.
You know, yeah. So I think that also people need to make their own decisions.
They're going to anyways.
Really. Yeah, they are. I mean, regardless of what I say.
Yeah.
That's why sending advice in general is inadvisable.
But it almost seems to me like a form of therapy, but in a tangible kind of fun way. And whenever I chat with you about it, it feels therapeutic.
It is. It actually is a form of therapy. You get to sit down and think through it, maybe in a way that you might not have thought of it before. Mm-hmm. Or as tarot often works like this, things will come up that are kind of like bubbling up for you, but you haven't come to terms with yet.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Okay. When you read my tarot cards for the first time, I was nervous. And I think I think I agreed because I did have a couple of beers. But if you remember, all of my cards were about work. I was like, look, work looks great. Amazing. That makes me happy. And you were like, this is boring. Let's choose a couple more cards. And I was like, okay. And then the juicy cards came up. And the two cards that came up were like a man with like 20 swords in his chest. And the card with like a magnificent rainbow. And then we spent some time trying to piece together what those two things meant. And mm-hmm. like at that point in time, that's all I was really doing. And it was really going well for me. Everything was going as planned. And so the two things that came afterwards were a little bit intimidating and scary, especially when you don't know what the cards mean. So you did an excellent job of like explaining to me what those cards mean, but it can be, I get why people are a bit nervous.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it happens often, where you think you feel a certain way about a person or a job or mm-hmm. whatever, and then something can come up in the reading that provokes questions around it. And it kind of makes you disentangle how you actually feel and what doubts are actually there. And I think that's the more unknown side of it. But also, I always start a reading with showing people the scariest cards.
Really? Oh, okay.
I'm like, okay, I'm just going to put these out here.
Just so you know.
Yeah. So I explain, I often take 5 minutes and I go through and I explain what tarot cards are. And I explain the two different decks and, you know, the death card and the 10 of swords and the hanged man. And, you know, there's some cards that visually can be a bit shocking.
For sure.
Yeah. And that's the 10 of swords. That was the
10
one.
Of swords.
Yeah. the knives in the person's back.
But yeah. And you had said, you had to explain to me, it was like, it's just the end of something and the beginning of something new. And I was like,
well, yeah. And swords are all mental energy. So mm-hmm. the 10 of swords is like, you've thought this to death.
Oh, I see.
It's the end of the cycle of like anxiety and keeping yourself up all night, thinking about something. Yeah. So that all has to do with thought pattern.
Oh, interesting. So much deeper than you'd think.
Oh, that's one card you can sit there for an hour and talk about.
Oh my God. I find it so interesting. So like, when did you realize that you had this ability or that you were interested in learning more about tarot cards and astrology?
I started reading about astrology as soon as I could read.
Uh-huh.
So I remember being like 6 or 7 at my grandmother's house, and my aunt had a baby names book there. Mm-hmm. And every Sunday we used to go to my grandmother's house and I would always get the book out, and all of the astrological signs were in the back with long descriptions of what each sign meant. And I would just sit there and, like, you know, I was able to read better and better as time went on, and then like read up on every single planet I possibly could, you know, from books from the library. And that just always stuck with me. And my older sister, Angela, was very much into astrology and tarot. She was just always a mentor in some ways. I think I was 12 when I was first introduced to tarot. I remember the first card I ever pulled. It was the Hanged Man.
Ooh.
Which I found really scary.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Well,
there's a whole story behind that card, but waiting and surrender are like two of the main themes are very important in life. I'll leave it at that. But
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's coming to a point of enlightenment through surrendering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very Neptunian, Piscesian kind of card.
Okay.
They're all linked to the astrological signs as well.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So your card would be the Chariot, the Cancerian card, but your Leo-y card would be the Sun.
Okay.
Yeah. So we all have certain cards as well. So yeah. So I started reading for people about 11 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really cool. And then obviously it's progressed since then. So you've continued reading and you've like learned more and you've continued to grow and you've educated yourself. But I know that there have been a few women in your life who have really mentored you. And so I'm just curious about the mentors that you had and how they kind of shaped your, I guess, your practice and your ideology around it.
Well, I started getting readings when I was 19.
Hmm.
Yeah, different things. And I was always so interested, but intrigued and a little bit scared.
Yeah.
You know,
it is
like,
scary.
It can be a bit scary because you're like, what is this person going to say to me?
Yeah.
But yet, you know, you still go.
And sometimes you're not ready to know. You're like, you know what?
Oh, no, for sure.
Let's close that book.
Yeah, exactly. There's somebody, but I mean, that happens too as a reader where I'll say something and you know it strikes a chord. I can feel that it strikes a chord with somebody, but then you feel the door close on it. And yeah. You just leave it. You leave it be. You don't try to push something that somebody doesn't want to hear. That's for sure. In terms of mentorship, even just the readers that you make a relationship with, they often teach you about what they're doing.
Hmm.
So Pierre Bellanger is in Halifax. He's a tarot reader. I actually took a course with Pierre on tarot. But then just going back to see him time and again, you build a relationship and they teach you very informally. But it does become a bit of a mentorship because you can't really get that same type of connection. Yeah. And oftentimes, or at least in my experience, the readers that I've gone to and I've built relationships with, they were so generous with their time and their knowledge. Very generous. Vivian McDonald Chapman was another one of those readers. And she was, I don't throw the word psychic around too lightly. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm intuitive and I'm an intuitive reader. I wouldn't say I'm a psychic reader. Like she was next level.
That's so cool.
Like magical. Mm-hmm. She would just be so kind and patient and would just really talk through the whole process. And yeah, she was a wonderful, wonderful reader.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think about those things a lot. And when you talk about like patience and like kindness in those situations, I think it's so paramount. I've told you before about my niece and I won't name names, but she has been super, I guess intuitive is a great word, since she was very, very young and would say some like really intense things that we didn't really understand. And we're like, she's young, like she's just like learning what's going on around her, but it didn't disappear as she got older. And I always really felt for her because there is so much stigma around astrology and tarot card reading and clairvoyance, that when you're young and you see these judgments and these misconceptions, you just kind of like hide these really innate talents and feelings and intuitions rather than play on them and enhance them. And I think that that's really sad because we don't understand something or something seems strange to us, or maybe our understanding of something has been tainted by our culture, doesn't mean that it's not real or valid. And so I think that it's cool to know that there are people you can chat with who are open, especially in that community. I imagine it's quite small. And so it's good to know that the people in the community are so caring and open and willing to share and chat. And I bet it's because they know exactly what it's like to have that curiosity and that intuitiveness and not have anyone pay mind to it.
Right. I think we all have the ability to be really intuitive, and we often are as children.
Mm-hmm.
And then we think our way out of it.
Yeah.
Or we're taught to think our way out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that unfortunately dwindles a little bit until you're able to sit down with yourself again and have some time and space to rebuild it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm hoping that people are more open, at least now, that people aren't shunned. or made to feel like they're weird or mm-hmm. or different, because it seems to be the more you talk to people, anybody, the more connections people have to either themselves or their family or friends who actually are into these things, mm-hmm. And or practice themselves.
Yeah. I think behind closed doors, a lot of people probably have this curiosity and like strange experiences and even strange family experiences. Every culture has like something really interesting to offer, but I always talk about my dad's Lebanese culture, and like the belief in a curse is so real and alive, which is why people wear the evil eye. In our culture, it's like you can't wear an evil eye with a cross because that's sacrilegious. But we come from a very like Christian religious family. So it's so interesting to me that like the evil eye is very disconnected from religion. It's more of a cultural thing. And so, yeah, you don't wear them together, but you still believe in both very firmly. They are two conflicting worlds that people have like somehow learned to conjoin, which I think is really, really interesting. In Lebanon, you very much believe that if you have a curse, you can create a spell and that curse will dissipate. Like that's so real and alive. Reading coffee cups is still super real. It's just interesting. Like the cultural, I think culture comes into it quite a bit and makes really shifts people's perspectives of it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And so if we're just a bit more open to it, not everyone grew up with it being normal or normalized. But if we just open our minds up to it, it's super interesting.
What's really interesting about at least in the community that I'm from, so in Nova Scotia, there's still tons of informal education networks within any kind of practitioner, like with any, like with Reiki or tarot or astrology or shamanism or, you know, like all different kinds of practices, spiritual mm-hmm. practices that, you know, you don't take at your local university. Mm-hmm. And so I found out about Holly Poole, who is a astrologer in outside of Halifax. And Vivian actually told me about Holly. She's like, cool. If you want to take any courses in astrology, look up Holly. I'm like, okay. So I did. And so I took 3 courses with Holly in her basement with a bunch of older women. I was in my 20s and everybody else was in their late 50s and 60s. And
that's like, why am I here?
But that's how I learned. And it was literally like, you know, photocopied handouts and everything by hand.
Nice.
Yeah. And I learned so much, from that.
That's amazing. You know, just to have someone like behind you to support you a little bit and validate what you're going through and what you're feeling is so helpful. So it's cool that you got that experience, especially in your 20s when it's kind of confusing to be learning something new at that age that already puts you into the space of an outsider, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think I've always been not afraid to do that in a way, just because I've wanted to know about it so badly.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's a little bit scary, but then I just think, well, I think the benefits are going to outweigh
totally.
Me not doing this mm-hmm. and then like being upset that I didn't do it. So I actually pitched the idea of the interviewing project with my friend Andrea that I ended up doing to my thesis supervisor back in 2012.
No way.
I did.
That's so cool. I was actually going to ask you, why didn't you do it for your research? That's so funny.
So my idea was looking at the informal education networks of psychics and other alternative spiritual practitioners in Nova Scotia mm-hmm. through an ethnographic study. And so that would have been like interviews, spending time with people at home, that type of thing. However, my supervisor is very wise. That sounds like a super interesting thesis.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to be able to get a job after.
Yeah.
And also, I don't do ethnography. And then being my stubborn self, I did it anyway.
Yeah, good though. I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, so it was a really interesting experience. Actually presenting this research I did it at ICQI, which is the International mm-hmm. Congress for Qualitative Inquiry.
Yeah.
And in 2014, I presented it as an arts-based methodology for destigmatizing spiritual work.
Mm.
And it takes place in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. A lot of the people who go to the conference, the ones who at least were in my room, were from the southern states. And so mm-hmm. there was a lot of silence, but it wasn't until afterwards I thought about it. And I was like, oh, right. it might have been a really like religious crowd that I was presenting to.
Yeah.
Or like people don't really talk about this stuff in academia, but I made it about the methodology and not about the content.
I want to know about the content. Well, if you can remember, what were some of your main, and not even main findings, that's such academic talk, but what were the things that really struck you, that like hit home for you, that really like resonated with your experience and elevated your knowledge of the field in general?
Well, what was so interesting was how crazy busy these people's schedules are and how many people book in like 6 months in advance.
Wow.
3 to 6 months usually in advance. Especially there was one particular healer who does hypnosis or hypnotherapy, but also like past life regression stuff and also energy healing.
Ooh.
A really incredible healer. And she was booking, I think I had to book 8 months in advance, something like that. Wow. With her. And you know, you try to get people to open up, like, okay, well, what types of people come to you?
Yeah.
Anywhere from neighbors all the way up to like celebrity, government officials, like you name it.
Wow.
And more, so many people actually seek out different types of what it is. It's healing, whether it's tarot or astrology. I mean, it's guidance, but so much of it is healing work, and offering people some type of therapy, whether it's even just chatting through issues.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the things, was even though people might not know it, how busy these people are.
Okay. Yeah.
Like how popular it is.
Yeah.
Even though like most of these people don't have websites, they're not online. They're like in their 60s, 70s. They are just go-to knowledge keepers. And what was another thing? How supportive and how they've built such a tight-knit community. Even over, say, 20, 30 years, found each other, whether it was through the internet, when the internet first came out,
Yeah. Maybe
talking about this, saying the internet came out and all of a sudden I had, you know, all kinds of people like me around. Yeah. So
one serious benefit of the internet is like bridging those communities that otherwise wouldn't be able to be bridged. Yeah.
Exactly. But from there, you know, they started, there's a couple of people who talked about starting the psychic fair that they had for people to come and to learn about what they do and how people exchange information. And they often read for each other and do sessions for each other as energy exchanges, that sort of thing. So the informal educational practice of it, like even from like a research perspective, was really interesting because you learn from people directly in their homes in Nova Scotia.
Ooh.
So yeah. So when you go get a reading, most often you go to somebody's house, especially if you have a good rapport or if you're referred to by somebody else that they know.
Hmm.
And it's a very,
intimate.
It is
comfortable.
Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it takes a lot of trust on both ends, especially meeting somebody for the first time where you're not sure and you're going to somebody's house, you know, like there's a lot of unknowns there.
Yeah.
But looking back and thinking about the people I've met and the homes that they welcome you into and everything else, it's just actually an amazing experience.
I understand now why it's so valuable and how it can really make a difference for somebody who's struggling to like communicate with somebody face to face in like a super vulnerable situation. Not that it's not vulnerable, because it was really vulnerable, but it was like a vulnerability I was comfortable participating in because we had this thing in between us that kind of, for in my experience, allowed both of us to, what's the word I'm looking for? Like,
well, it's definitely something that is co-created.
Right. Yes.
Like it's an iterative process thing. And that's why I think it is therapeutic, but not in the traditional come in and just sit down and start talking type of way. Really enjoy it. And my older sister, Angela, is an excellent tarot reader. And we read for each other all the time.
No way. That's so cool.
Because I mean, reading for yourself, you don't necessarily trust that you're just going to glaze over something.
Yeah.
You're like, eh, that's fine. I don't really want to deal with that today, but you know, Angela will always let me know what she sees and likewise. She's incredibly intuitive. And everybody, I think, and everybody I've gone to, readers and different practitioners, they have a different style and they have different themes that I guess they're better at talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. For me, when people come to me, I'm very comfortable with talking about career, major life decisions, life path things, emotional things too, like family issues or even relationship things. But Angela is very good at karmic issues. That makes sense. So like kind of the deeper, darker.
Oh, I see.
The difficult relationships. Ooh, like, okay. You know, the really tough ones that take a lot of time and energy and a lot of help to get out of sometimes or see through or to fix or anything like that. She's really good at those. Not saying that I'm not, but I tend to delve a little bit differently.
Yeah, everyone has their specialty or their approach.
And she can really bring out a lot of the kind of deeper emotional parts in the reading.
Okay. Have you gotten better at reading people more quickly? Like just even intuitively understanding where someone's coming from or their...
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's something that a lot of us have. And even speaking to so many women about this, actually in the last year, I would say, we're taught to rationalize those first instincts. Mm-hmm. And so we put them in the back of our mind. And then when things might reveal themselves down the road, we go, well, I knew that, but
yeah,
you didn't trust yourself. And so sometimes it's not even a matter of, it is about fine tuning a little bit, but it's also a matter of trusting what you actually know. And that's the harder part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. Because something I struggle with is like, is this my intuition or is this my fear talking? Even knowing enough about psychology to understand why people do the things that they do, right? So you could rationalize anyone's behavior at any point in time. And so I wonder about that. Like, how do we differentiate like this intuition versus our fear versus this rationalization?
For me, fear often comes from the ego. Mm-hmm. So I don't have enough, like if the fears of not having enough, not being enough, something, you know, being attached to your identity, that's where often fear comes from, out of a fear of lack. Intuition for me is, it always feels like a pull in a direction and not a block from that. Mm-hmm. So fear often blocks you from things, where intuition for me at least is guiding, and it guides me to do things that I look back and I think that was bold. But I was guided to do it and I trusted it. And so I did it.
Yeah.
And I never second guess that. And I can sometimes tell if there's fear behind it. If I ask myself how I'll feel after I make a decision tomorrow, in a week, in a month, and in a year. Mm-hmm. And if I feel like I'm going to regret not doing something, then that's based out of fear and not out of actually wanting to do something, but just being afraid to do it.
Yeah. That's tough for everybody. And we haven't been taught to rely on our intuition. We've been taught to rely on rationalization.
Yeah.
And that's when you have to like turn inwards and just be like, what's real for me right now?
Exactly. And that's where having that connection to your inner guidance system.
Yeah.
Well, your intuition and knowing what is right for you. You can call it your own intuition. You can just call it being in touch with really your own wants and needs. Mm-hmm. And I think it is different than pure intuition. When you purely intuit something, it is different than trying to figure out what you want and need to. Yeah. There's even a different level of understanding there. It brings back to the conversation that we were having before about why people are especially... A lot of women, especially in academia or people who are in professional realms, are afraid to even open up about this stuff. It's because we have been taught to rationalize so much that, you know, if we talk about this stuff, it makes us seem irrational.
Mm-hmm. It's sad to me that we're in this day and age where we're like fighting for women's rights, but there's still so much fear about the way that we can behave. I think that a lot, especially in academia, like who... Do I be myself in this space or do I be this like academic version of myself that I've created? That's still a part of me, but that certainly isn't my whole self. And you're right. I think most of it often does come out of fear of judgment, because if you stray from like what people consider rational and academic, but it's going to take a lot of time to unlearn that. And I think it's really sad that like people like you who have these like really innate, beautiful talents and interests kind of shut them off and turn them off to the outside world out of that like fear.
Yeah. In the academic sense, maybe a little bit of fear of not being taken seriously.
Yeah, for sure.
Not being marketable, as I was told.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Whatever that means in the end. But more so being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to be, you know, in the world of research where we're asked to, you know, talk about reliability and validity and data, and it doesn't fit with that worldview at all. It doesn't fit within the positivist or empiricist understanding of what knowledge is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is more and more space in tiny chunks within the academic realms, like within post-humanist mm-hmm. work even, or even like the really interesting feminist epistemological ethnographic stuff. Like totally. There are emerging small pockets mm-hmm. there. That when you're among them, you're all speaking the same language.
Yeah.
And there is almost this centeredness of, for a lack of a better word, that ontological part, that the being and knowingness of that there's so many more interconnections here than what we can call capital K knowledge. And we're not talking about reliability, we're talking about experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings in a wider array of experiences, including our spiritual lives as well, and however we wanted to define that.
Right.
Okay. There was one thing.
Yeah.
Because we talked about this at the beginning, but what does spirituality mean to you?
To me? Oh, Pam. You know, my dad is Lebanese and he's very, very religious. And he prays for us all the time to the point where he puts so much energy into the universe for us that I believe him. I believe in his prayers, whether it's real or not. I think when you have enough faith in something and enough, you put enough energy towards something, you can do incredible things with that energy. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that's what spirituality means to me. What does it mean to you?
This was hard to try to pin down.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote something, so I feel like I'm cheating.
No, not at all. No, not at all. That's fine.
Okay. So for me, I started thinking, I was like, okay, well, it's definitely based in my faith in life in general.
Okay.
And the goodness of life and my hope in that. But it's also how I feel about my connection to everything around me. So that's either friends, family, partners, work, colleagues even, and how I treat them.
Okay.
And you know, the energy exchanges there sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think for me, it's literally the totality of everything that makes me who I am, including that past person and the person I'm becoming.
Aw.
Mm-hmm.
That's really lovely. I like that question though. And honestly, if I had to sum it up in one word, it would just be my dad. Like, he's taught me so much about just the power of belief. And sometimes people will ask me like, and I don't see myself as like an absurdly confident person, but in my lifetime, I've heard so many people come to me and be like, how are you so confident? Like, what is wrong? Like, what's going on? And I always say, like, when we were growing up, my dad never let us say one bad word about ourselves. Like, if one bad thing slipped out of our mouths about ourselves, we would like get a verbal beating, like not allowed. And he would just like scream at you, like, you are the best. And it wasn't like you're better than everybody else. It was like you are the best. You're the best you can be. No one can tell you any differently. And we were always kind of painted with this like, okay, like I am the best, I guess, whether I fail or not, which was really cool because he did expect a lot of us. But if we failed or if we didn't fail, his idea was like, no one can tell you how you feel about yourself. Nobody can tell you whether you pass or fail. No one can tell you whether you're successful or not. Like, you say that. And it really, and we weren't also, we also weren't allowed to say bad things to each other. which was really a beautiful thing. Mm. Now that I'm older, I like really appreciate all the things that the way he raised us. But that, like, back to what you were saying, it's like that hope, that belief, like that's all very spiritual, that you have, that is ingrained in me now. And I'm so thankful for that, because even in my darkest moments, like I always have maybe it's not even confidence, like a self-worth that like I don't even know how to let go of. And sometimes that can get in the way of things.
No, it's very healthy, because it often takes many years to have that type of sense, or that sense of self-worth.
Totally. And he just ingrained it in us. And that's what I think that's what made me realize that things, you control more than you think you do. Just like,
yeah. And I mean, it's really interesting. I think it's amazing that he taught you that the way you talk to yourself or about yourself, or even about the people that you're around closely matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pam, that was so informative. Thank you so much. Yeah, I think this is going to shine a lot of light on a field that people don't know much about, and hopefully make people feel more comfortable if they are interested to like pursue it.
No, thank you so much. And for making the time to have this discussion. I know you and I have been talking about this stuff for a little while now, but I was so excited when you first pitched the idea to me, and I hope that you get a good response from it. And
you feel good about it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good. Me too. Oh, okay. So good to see you, Pam.
You too. Have a good one.
You too.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love to hear what you think and anything more or less that you'd like to learn about. Comment here, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jamilee.baroud, jamilee.baroud. Until next time, shine light online, and I'll talk to you soon.